morning. Good morning, Constance. I just want to let you know right off the bat, I quit. I'm really thankful that Pastor Randy preached the message that he did last week on not complaining. So I just want to let you know right now, I'm not complaining about the weather. I am giving you an update and just letting you know how this has affected me, just so you're aware, but this isn't a complaint. I'm just letting you know. Yesterday was my birthday. Wasn't that a great way to celebrate? Spend time watching the snow. There have been many years in my life where on my birthday, up in the Brainerd Lakes area, I had a friend who ran some of the golf courses up there, and he would make arrangements for me and some of my friends to go golfing on April 14th. That didn't happen this year. That's not a complaint. It's just an update, mind you. This morning, I got ready to go and came outside, and when I opened my garage door, there was about 3 to 4 inches of snow right in front of my garage door, and I figured, shoot, I can make it through this. So I got in my pickup and backed out and didn't even get turned around and got stuck in the middle of my driveway. Jim mentioned this cardio workout that he was so thankful for. I'm so happy for you. So I blew the snow out and got my pickup out and made it here. And of course, I know this afternoon I'm going to have to go and clean out the rest of my driveway because my neighbor has already cleaned out all of his and it all looked good and perfect. And mine's a mess because I just made a little bit of a path. And I don't want to be that slug in the neighborhood, that guy who doesn't kind of keep up. So I need to get that taken care of because I need to keep up with my neighbor. And you know, that just is important. And that's just life. And I'm not complaining. I guess I'm just giving a report. Then yesterday I posted a picture outside my front door just to let some friends know of kind of what the situation was. And I had a friend post back to me. He lives in Hawaii. And the caption under the picture was, "Don't you hate it when you walk outside your front door in your sandals and the sun kind of blinds you for a moment?" I'm so happy for him. And then yesterday being my birthday, I decided that I should probably take a look in the mirror. I try not to do that too often. But when I do, when people grow old, different people notice different things about themselves, and some people notice wrinkles here, something that's happening there, and oh, they just bemoan the fact that they're getting older, and none of those things really bother me, except one. I really miss having hair. I wish I had more hair, because you know what, if I had more hair, I think I'd be cooler. I think I'd be a better preacher. I think I'd be more loved by not only my wife, but everyone else around me as well. You know, some of you are going to watch basketball tonight, and when the Timberwolves play, now Jimmy Butler has hair. I think if I had Jimmy Butler's hair, I'd just be a better preacher. And if not a better preacher, at least a better man. I'm convinced of that. And if not Jimmy Butler, I just even look at, you know who else has good hair? Pastor Aaron has good hair. You know, every week I see Pastor Aaron and he's got hair. And he's got hair that grows. I mean like inches overnight. So that his hair grows so fast that he can come with a whole different hairdo in a couple weeks from now. And 2 weeks later he'll have a different hairdo because his hair just grows. And I wish I had Aaron's hair. Actually, Aaron's kind of a tough one for me to look at because he's got other things that I want too. Some of you don't know this, but when I was in college, I was a music major. And I wish I could sing like Aaron, especially with so many worship songs that are a little bit higher in register, and I can't sing high. I can do the low, but and then Aaron is such a gifted musician. You know, and I watch him up there, and I wish I could play guitar like he does. Or piano, or drums, or bass, or almost any other instrument you'd ever want to mention. I mean, he's just so gifted. And it'd be so fun to be able to have those gifts. It'd be so cool. And don't we all want to be cool? And I've just demonstrated for you the comparison game that so many of us can subtly fall into. And our goal today is to look at comparison and comparing and to come to the point, be able to say, I quit. That I don't want to be a person who goes through life building my image of who I am based on where I fit in the whole comparison game. And for those of you who are keeping notes, I wrote down just a few things about the comparison game as we begin, just to let you know what's going on. You know what? Everyone is tempted to play the comparison game. If you have a mirror in your house, you're tempted to play. If you go through the grocery line and stop and look at some of the magazines of the beautiful people and what's going on in their lives, you're tempted to play. If you've stepped into your closet and looked and said, I just don't have anything to wear because it's not in style and the clothes that I have are so last year. If you've ever had thoughts like that, you've played the comparison game. Almost everybody plays it at some point or another. You just try and figure out where you fit in the pecking order of whether it's at work, at home, in church, wherever. You just want to figure out. I know as well that when you play the comparison game, most everyone else is a threat. In fact, everyone else is a threat. It's not just that I have an antagonist or a rival. It's that if that antagonist and rival goes away, there's going to be somebody else. Because somebody is always trying to take my position. And I don't want to be passed by. I want to be significant and important, and I want to be cool. And all these things are relational things in terms of comparison. And everyone's a threat. And I know as well is that when you play the comparison game, that those who play will pay almost anything to win the game. And can you believe the crazy things that we do? One of the crazy things that I see people do, and it's all in the name of the comparison game, is they pluck their eyebrows. I've never done that, but it looks like it hurts. And why would you do that other than somebody has decided that having a certain kind of eyebrow looks cooler than another kind, and you don't so desperately want to keep up with somebody else and have others think well of you that you're going to pluck your eyebrows? Why do you do that? We have to play the comparison game, and we color our hair, lest heaven forbid someone thinks that we're older than what we are. And we have liposuction, and we have plastic surgery, and some people get Botox. And don't you sometimes feel sorry for some of the beautiful people of the world who are getting a little bit older, and they've decided that somehow they need to extend their position in society by getting Botox so they somehow look younger? And for some, maybe it works, I don't know, but the only ones that I end up seeing are the ones where the person ends up looking like the Cowardly Lion. And they smile, but something just isn't quite right. And we do these crazy things in the name of the comparison game because somehow what others think of us is important, and we'll pay almost anything to have that right. But if you play the comparison game, everyone loses because sooner or later, the position that you thought that you had so securely will no longer be yours. So I quit. I quit playing that game. And I want to get to the place in my life and would encourage you that in your life as well to get beyond the comparison game and to live life in a way that's better and different. And we're going to talk about that today. And we're going to do so from the lens of three different snapshots in Scripture. And I'll let you know up front, two of them are negative examples. One's a very positive example. And we're going to look at those today and see what we can learn about comparing and hopefully get ourselves to a better place. The first snapshot I want to look at is King Saul. His story is told in the Old Testament, and we're going to look at his story specifically as we come into 1 Samuel chapter 18. Now in chapter 17, I'm just going to give you a little bit of the backstory. In chapter 17, we find the people of Israel and the people of the Philistines, their armies at war with each other. They're kind of stalemated at this point with both of their encampments. And the only action that's really happening here is that there's one Philistine, a guy that maybe you've heard of named Goliath, who every morning and every night would come out and talk to the troops of Israel and say, "Yo, what's up, dudes?" And he'd end up heckling and taunting them, saying, "Any of you got game? If so, you come, bring it on. I'll take you." They did that every day. Nothing happened until finally this other guy, this Israelite, another guy that you've probably heard of named David, came out and did battle against Goliath. Killed him with his slingshot and a stone. And when Goliath died, the Philistine armies panicked. The forces of Israel came and they totally defeated the Philistines. They overran their camps. They plundered their camps. And plundering an enemy's camps was a good thing because that was your bonus for being in the army. You got all this other weaponry and these things that had value and that you kept them for themselves. And now we pick up the story in 1 Samuel chapter 18, verse 5. Whatever mission Saul sent David on, David was so successful that Saul gave him a high rank in the army. This pleased all the troops and Saul's officers as well. So at this point, I mean, Saul is riding high. He's the king of the nation that's just defeated their arch enemy. His soldiers think well of him. He has David in his ranks, and his son Jonathan and David have become besties. So Saul's in a good position, and they ride into town, and when the men were returning home after David had killed the Philistine, the women came out, which lets you know already, it's a little hint of the writer saying, a problem is coming. That's all I'm going to say about that. The women came out from all the towns of Israel to meet King Saul with singing and dancing, with joyful songs and with timbrels and lyres. And they sang this song. Saul has slain his thousands, David his 10,000s. And remember a couple weeks back when Pastor Sean said that the song of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood kind of got stuck in his brain? That Saul heard this song once and it got stuck in his. And Saul was very angry with this refrain and it displeased him greatly. They have credited David with tens of thousands, he thought, but me with only thousands. What more can he get but the kingdom? And in verse 9 it says, from that time on, Saul kept a close eye on David. Because Saul was playing the comparison game. For those of you that know the rest of the story, you know that this was kind of a defining moment in Saul's life. That from this day forward, he never trusted David. He was consumed with David and trying to figure out how to get rid of him. And we learned some things about the comparison game during Saul's story that are kind of amazing, and they're amazing and for all of us. For Saul, for example, you know that Saul had virtually everything going for him. Back in chapter 9, we're told that when he was selected to be the king, that he was as handsome as any man in Israel. And he was a full head taller than anyone else. So here's a guy who's tall, dark, and handsome. And he's the king, and he's just had a victory, and he's secure in everything in his country. But in the midst of everything that's going for him, he feels like he's losing. You know what we'd say at this point? We'd look at him and say, oh, that poor man, he's suffering from low self-esteem. If only we could find something that he was good at, so he wouldn't feel so bad about himself. But when you have low self-esteem and you play the comparison game, your life is a bottomless pit. And no matter what you have good going for you, you will lose because you're playing the comparison game. Parents, don't teach your kids to play the comparison game. You're setting them up to lose. The other craziness in Saul's life is that there wasn't one moment where David gave him any reason to fear him. David was 100% faithful, was 100% loyal. David even had opportunity to kill Saul on numerous times, and on one occasion in particular, when all of his troops were saying, "David, this is it. It's God's will for you to kill this guy. God has put him into your hands. Now take him down." And David said, "Who am I to put my hand on the Lord's anointed?" And David was basically saying, "I refuse to play the comparison game because it's not a matter of competition." But when you play the comparison game, you're always competing and you're always insecure and you're always wondering who your enemy is, because there's always somebody that you're afraid is going to take your position. Saul lost the comparison game. And by the end of his life, he was a fragile, shallow, insecure man who lost his son, lost his friends, lost his integrity, lost his kingdom, and lost his life, all the while playing games that you're going to lose. My second snapshot is maybe the flip side of the coin. If Saul is the side of the coin that is low self-esteem, we're going to look at someone on the other side of the coin who suffers from high self-esteem. His story is told over in the Gospel of Luke, in Luke chapter 18. Now, if you remember Luke sets out at the beginning of his gospel and he tells us that, "I'm taking all this stuff and I'm trying to tell you what happened in chronological order." So over and over again, Luke says things like, "and then," and 2 days later. He's always trying to keep things in order. But it's almost like Luke is writing and he's sitting at his desk, and as he's getting to this point in the gospel, and he says, "I've got a few stories here. And I know that they're true and I know that they're happened, but I'm not exactly sure when or where they did. So I'm going to lump them all together." And I think there's like 5 different stories in a row where Luke kind of says, "Oh yeah, and then there was the time, and then there was the time, and then there was the time." And the story in Luke 18 that we're going to look at is one of those. It's a parable of Jesus. And it starts out like this. Luke says, "To some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. 2 men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee, the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, 'God, I thank you that I am not like other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even this tax collector. I fast twice a week, and I give a tenth of all that I get.' But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but he beat his breast and said, 'God, have mercy on me. I'm a sinner. I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted.'" I keep coming back to this last part of the verse. In a society where we're all about self-promotion and the art of making ourselves look good on resumes and in conversations, and that those who exalt themselves will be humbled. Jesus was a master storyteller. And the way that parables work are this. They're written in such a way that the first time you hear the story and you hear the account about this Pharisee and the way he looked down at the tax collector, that your inner response would be, "I can't believe he would do such a thing. I would never do that." And then hopefully this little message goes off in your brain that says, "Ding, ding, ding. You just did." That if I put myself in a position where I look at a Pharisee and say, "I would never do that," I'm doing exactly what the Pharisee did when he looked down at the tax collector and said, "I would never do that." And it's a part of the comparison game that sneaks up on us, where all of a sudden we're looking around and looking at other people, and when we say, well, at least I'm not bad as bad as that person, and I'm not bad as that person, I'm not bad as that person, that we're doing that flip side of the self-esteem thing, and that it's not low self-esteem, but it's high self-esteem. And we think of ourselves as better than what we should. I've learned, and I've shared with some of you before, that one of the dangerous words in our language is the word them. So whenever we talk about them Democrats, them Republicans, them young kids, them senior citizens, that whenever we have that mindset, we're starting to put ourselves in a position of superiority, that we are better than them. And the moment we do, we're guilty of the same sin that the Pharisee is guilty of. And instead of rejoicing in the goodness and greatness of God's mercy for us, we've put ourselves in a position of thinking that we deserve more than the next person because we're better. You see, once again, I need to talk about this again, and I want to be gentle, but I want to be firm at the same time. It's playing the comparison game, that any time that we think we're better than someone or we think we're worse than someone, we're playing the same game from the different side of the coin, and it's the game that causes us to lose. So it isn't the person who thinks too lowly of themselves. It isn't the person who thinks too much of themselves. The key is to be the person who doesn't think of themselves. That I quit playing that game. And I'm going to look for another equation and another value that's beyond my opinion of myself and how I relate to others. But I need to find something deeper and better and more valuable that I can cling to build my life on, that doesn't leave me at risk all the time. And Paul's a wonderful example of that. Let's look at his story over in Philippians chapter 4. Philippians is one of my favorite books. I love how Paul plays himself, and we learn something about him, and it shows us also some subtle aspect of the comparing game when we start looking at the circumstances of other people and we say, you know what, I think my life would be better if. And we start talking about our circumstances, and we use our circumstances to communicate to other people that we deserve something or should have something, or that something's wrong. We just use them in a way to communicate negative things. And let me tell you, if anybody needed to do that or could have done that, it would have been Paul. Can you think of all the things that Paul could have said in his letter to the church at Philippi? Because remember, Paul is presently in prison. He is waiting to argue his case before Caesar, knowing fully well that he might be executed for his faith. And in the midst of this, all the things that Paul could have said, he could have said, hey guys at Philippi, I remember Philippi. That was the place where I went and they arrested me for doing nothing bad. They beat me and they put me in prison, put me in stocks. They tortured me. Oh yeah, I remember Philippi. I hope you guys realize how much sacrifice I put in for you. Oh, and boy, my body sure hurts. You know, a body hurts after it's been beaten all these times and I've been stoned and left for dead and everything else. I wish I didn't have all these things, but I guess that's the price you pay when you suffer for the Lord. You guys wouldn't know that, would you? But boy, I do. I wish I didn't suffer so much. You guys are free. You're able to come and go. I'm not. I'm in prison. I wish I was like you. Oh, and what did you have for dinner yesterday? You know what I had for dinner yesterday? I had bread and water. That's what I have every day. It wouldn't have to be that way, because where I'm at in the kind of prison that I'm in, if you would send me more money so that I could buy food for myself, I could have better things to eat. But you know what I had yesterday? I had bread and water, because you didn't. What did you have? And we start playing these games, and you've seen them, you've experienced, if you've never done it yourself, you've been around people who play these guilt cards on you and let you know that really, that because of their circumstances, they're better. And you've been tempted as well to play a card that says, you know, I'd be happier if it would quit snowing. I'd be happier if I was in Hawaii. I'd be happier if I wasn't in prison. I'd be happier if I was married. I'd be happier if I had another kid. And all these cards we would play where I'd be happier if. And none of them work. Because at the end of the day, they're all part of an entire system where we're gaining our worth and value from things around us instead of who God is. So let's see what Paul actually did say. Because, by the way, there was never a point in the whole book of Philippians where Paul complains. In fact, it's called the Epistle of Joy, or the Letter of Joy, because over and over again, Paul is expressing his gratitude and his thankfulness and his trust in God that no matter once what, whether he lives or dies, God is going to be praised. And finally, as we're coming to the conclusion, we'll pick it up in Philippians 4, verse 10. I rejoiced greatly in the Lord that at last you renewed your concern for me. Indeed, you were concerned, but you had no opportunity to show it. In other words, you guys were able to send me some money, and I'm so thankful. But by the way, I'm not saying this because I am in need. Because even if all I have is bread and water, I've learned to be content, whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. And I have learned that I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength. And we start to see a perspective of Paul where you can tell that his worth and value is not found in the comparison game of relating to other people, but it's found in his relationship with Jesus Christ. And he has built his life and his foundation on who Christ is and what Christ has done for him. And we're going to focus in on one little part of Philippians chapter 4, verse 12. One little part with two important words where he says that I have learned the secret of being content. First of all, I have learned. In other words, being content and having an image and a personality that's built on who God is does not come naturally. The natural thing is to do what everybody else does and to play this game and where do we fit and what's the pecking order and who's top dog, who's king of the hill. These are the conversations we've had since we were little. That's the natural way. But Paul has come to the point of saying, I'm no longer living the natural way, but I have learned a different way. And what I've learned, I have learned the secret. And then you know what Paul tells us the secret is? He doesn't. And in the notes today, I included everything else that I said today in terms of an outline form, except I didn't fill in what the secret of contentment is, because it's a secret. And I didn't want to have it written down there, because then it's no longer a secret. But I can tell you what the secret is. After years and years and years of in my own life, looking and studying and trying to find that place, to know where I fit and to be content, that I've truly come to the place where I have learned it. Took me a long time. Most of my life I lived as a bottomless pit, hoping that one more person would give me that one compliment to make me feel good about myself. But I've learned. the secret. And the secret is this. I focus on what I have instead of what I don't have. And what I have is the same thing that Paul had. I have a relationship with the King of the universe. I've been chosen and picked by him. I've been adopted into his family. I no longer have to play the games of who's first, like Paul admitted that he did back in chapter 3, where by a worldly standard of keeping score and comparison, he was the best of the best. But like Paul said, and I've thrown it all away as garbage because of the surpassing greatness of knowing Jesus Christ and having an identity that's rooted, that I have been created by him, I have been put on task by him to do his work, I've been promised an eternal home with him, and God loves me, and I love him, and it is well with my soul. Give me that 18-ounce ribeye. Sounds great. Give me bread and water. You know, in many ways, nothing has changed because my contentment is not built on my world. It's built on my identity with Jesus Christ. And it's not about having a low self-esteem that needs to be fixed or a high self-esteem that needs to be tempered. It's about having a God esteem where my identity is so rooted in who Jesus Christ is. And it's all that matters. And for those of you that might be caught in the comparison game, in the name of Jesus Christ, I give you permission to say, I quit. I quit trying to live up to others' thoughts and expectations. And instead, I will rejoice in what Christ has done for me. And I will build my life on the truth of who Jesus Christ is. All other ground is sinking sand. Let's pray. Lord, thank you. Thank you for showing us and giving us a better way to live. A life that's safe and meaningless and secure. Forgive me, forgive us for the times that we've been caught in the struggle and caught in the ideas of wondering who's first and if only. Lord, thank you for the freedom and joy that comes in a different kind of life. In Jesus' name.